This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women.
The National Defense Strategy really focuses us on near peer competitors.
The U.S. government, in fact, increased its contribution to WFP in order to assist.
Everything that we do in space, a lot of it can be applied to our life on Earth.
We feature women who are breaking barriers and shaping the future of foreign policy, national security, international business, and development. I'm Beverly Kirk, the director of the Smart Women, Smart Power Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. The civil war in Yemen is now in its fourth year. More than 14 million Yemenis, nearly half the country, are on the brink of famine. At least 85,000 children have already died from hunger and disease because of the war.
They've been reduced to aid dependency from the ambitions of the Arab Spring to starvation.
This week, the United Nations urged the warring parties to give access to grain that's at risk of rotting. The grain can feed 3.7 million people for a month. Aid workers haven't been able to reach the Red Sea mills in the port of Hodeidah for 5 months. I spoke with Jane Ferguson about the ongoing crisis in Yemen. Jane is a Beirut-based special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and has reported on the civil war. She's an expert on the region, having lived in the Middle East for 10 years. I asked Jane what type of devastation she's seen, how the economic turmoil is affecting Yemenis, and about the U.S. role in Yemen. Jane, welcome to Smart Women, Smart Power. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
You've been in the Middle East for about a decade. Give us a sense of the region and how it's changed in the last 10 years, and how does the conflict in the broader region impact what's happening in Yemen?
It has been a momentous, incredibly turbulent 10 years in the region. I mean, we as foreign correspondents have gone from seeing the Arab Spring or the roots of the Arab Spring take hold in 2011 and 12, and across the region and in so many of the nations that experienced peaceful uprisings in the beginning that turned into armed uprisings that turned into civil wars. That's basically what we have been witnessing over the last 10 years, unfortunately. The decline also in terms of the social conditions in some countries as a result, the humanitarian fallout as a result. We're talking about whether it's Yemen, also in places like Libya, Syria, Egypt. We've seen a push for an increase in rights or a push to remove certain dictatorial regimes, and then very, very much so a very strong push back from those regimes in places like Egypt and in Syria. Now, in Yemen, what we saw over the last 10 years was we saw the Arab Spring, and I was there in Sana'a whenever the protests were going on throughout 2011 and 12. And those protests were successful in removing the dictator Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had held power for over 30 years there. But they weren't successful, as many of the others in the region weren't, with replacing him with something that could provide human rights, a better economic stability for the country. And instead, we've seen chaos, but also, as you have mentioned, the wider conflict in the region rushing in to the vacuum that was left after Ali Abdullah Saleh was removed. And that wider conflict, of course, is the somewhat cold war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. After Ali Abdullah Saleh was pushed out of power, but he stayed in place, he stayed inside Yemen. He largely, you know, he was involved in helping the Houthi rebels from the north, the Zaydi rebel group from the north that he himself had been battling for years, helped them move into the capital of Sana'a and take control. That destabilized the peace process that was going on, or the negotiations to try to move Yemen towards a more consensus government. Those rebels are allied with Iran, and of course that also really sparked the pulling into the vacuum of the wider regional conflict. And Saudi Arabia, was faced with seeing its own border, a very, very lengthy border with Iran, now being entirely controlled by the border with Yemen, now seeing that border controlled by a rebel group that was allied with Iran. And so, of course, we've now seen, famously in 2015, the Saudis pull together a coalition of Arab countries and their militaries, supported to some extent by the United States, in a bombing campaign to try to remove the rebels. It managed to push them back north from where they had pushed right down to the south to the main southern capital of Aden, but it pushed them about halfway back north, and then that front line very, very quickly stopped. Since then, it's been a stalemate, and instead of any military victories on the battlefield, we've instead seen the growth and explosion of the world's worst humanitarian crisis and possible huge famine on the horizon.
I want to get to the humanitarian crisis in just a moment, but I want to follow up on the issue of Iran and Saudi Arabia. I've heard it referred to, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's sort of a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
It is on one level. It's important to remember that the war in Yemen has varying levels. These are overlapping wars. You have a very much so a Yemeni war. You have a Yemeni tribe on tribe fighting inside Yemen. And then above that, you have another level of this war, which is very much so the Saudi-led coalition and their partners, mainly the Emiratis from the United Arab Emirates, fighting against a group that they see as very, very much so militarily aligned with Iran. So for sure, this is absolutely a Cold War. It has, on one level, all of the sort of characteristics that you might have seen before in the region or across Africa during the Cold War between Russia and the United States in terms of backing opposing forces on the ground.
And let's talk a little bit more about that U.S. role in this conflict, because this crosses administrations. You mentioned 2015. That was the Obama administration, and the Trump administration has continued the support, correct?
That's correct. This very much so was an Obama-era war when it started. It also started, you know, the strife that was going on in Yemen was happening rather inconveniently for the Obama administration at similar timing, just as there was a real push to try to get the Iran deal off the ground and to really try to push towards at least some form of relations that could normalize there. And so here you had a war that was very much so running against, or very inconvenient, because the Saudis were watching the Iran deal and saying, you know, this is unacceptable to us. But at the same time, from their perspective, they're seeing what they believe to be a very hostile Iranian move in there. So for the Obama administration, this was a very delicate situation. So whenever the Saudis said, look, you know, we can't tolerate an Iranian proxy on our doorstep, we're forming a coalition, the Obama administration did support it. And initially there were American advisors in control rooms in Saudi Arabia and a lot more sort of logistical support that we do know was taking place, logistical and intelligence. But soon, very, very soon after the bombing campaign started in 2015, there were increasingly distressing events and incidences with the bombing campaign hitting sites that were basically areas that were filled with civilians, things like funerals, things like schools, or very often weddings. These sorts of gatherings were being hit. That provided a major challenge and difficulty for the Obama administration. And there was a pullback. You started to see some rhetoric, at least, coming out of the White House saying things like, this is not a blank check, and trying to somehow taper trying to help the Saudis basically show more restraint and a little bit more due diligence with their bombing campaign. It became a very difficult, difficult situation for the Obama administration. Since then, of course, now we have a much, much more robustly anti-Iran administration in the White House that has thrown support again behind the coalition.
I was just about to follow up with the question on, you know, what is the Trump administration doing that is significantly different from what the Obama administration did?
Largely not that much. There are some differences on the ground with regards to, we now know that there were some U.S. special forces on the Saudi side of the border until recently. That was reported in the Washington Post. As a result, that was quite a surprise, helping the Saudis do things like with helping them to prevent the missiles that were being fired across their border by the Houthis. So there have been some changes, but there hasn't been a massive increase in U.S. military support. It's more that there has been a maintenance of U.S. military support to a certain extent, despite very loud calls from the Senate and from congressmen and women to try to pull back on that, and basically from the international community talking about weapons sales. So in terms of logistics and the, you know, military support, it's not believed that there has been a major uptick in that. Instead, there's been a lot of defiance coming from the Trump administration in the face of much, much criticism of U.S. support for this coalition because of the humanitarian disaster caused by a lot of the tactics used in this war. Also, of course, famously, we've seen Trump talking up the arms sales and saying, you know, that the United States doesn't need to think about ethics at this time or about values. It needs to think about the bottom line and making these deals. So he's been more visible in his support.
And against all of this backdrop that you have so well laid out explaining the conflict, there is this incredible humanitarian crisis that is just enveloping the Yemeni people. You mentioned at the top that the country is literally on the brink of famine. Why is that? Because there hasn't been any kind of natural disaster that would cause a famine. I think you've written that this is a man-made famine.
It absolutely is. That's the biggest tragedy of the situation inside Yemen, is that Yemen has got food. Of course, the sort of blockade, the military blockade on the areas that the Houthi rebels control, which, you know, most people live in. It's not one sort of little enclave. It is most of the Yemenis live there. That has, you know, to a certain extent made it slightly difficult for food to get in, but it hasn't really limited access to food. What it has done is it has pushed prices up very slightly. During wartime, food prices go up anyway. Things like fuel, things like transport costs, everything gets harder. But what has really caused this disaster is a collapse of the economy. And this is the same story everywhere you go. I've traveled all across countrywide, these rural areas controlled by the rebels. And it's the same story everywhere you go. You could be in an area that hasn't been bombed at all, where people haven't really seen the war at all, but they lost their work. Effectively, hospitals are, their children's wards are filling up with kids whose fathers lost work because the economy has collapsed. And so people in Yemen were always poor. It's been a poor country for a very, very long time, back in 2011, 12, 13, during some of the unrest and the chaos as a result of the Arab Spring. There were malnutrition crises throughout then. But what's happened now is that people have no longer any ability to buy food. So that's why millions are going hungry. You had for years now, this war is in its fourth year now. People initially have what the aid agencies call coping strategies. And to you or I, what that really means is savings in the bank, perhaps some livestock like a cow and some sheep in the backyard, or a line of credit at a grocery store. Those things have run out now. And that's why, even though the situation hasn't changed that much militarily, that's why suddenly the humanitarian crisis is so, so much worse. Nobody can afford to buy food. And so agencies like the United Nations World Food Programme are trying to top up people's calorie intake. They're living off tea and bread. And that's fine for adults, but it's not going to keep children alive and babies alive. So that's effectively why the crisis has reached this point. The other thing that really is so striking about Yemen, and why it's important to get in there on the ground to report it, because, you know, there's only some, you know, statistics like 18 million people need food aid. That really is just a number. But whenever you're on the ground, you can really appreciate the scale of that. That is two-thirds of the country need help to survive. There's nowhere else on the planet like that. And anytime you talk to aid workers, they'll tell you they've never experienced such a widespread hunger in their entire careers. These are numbers worse than the things that I've seen in places like Sudan, in Syria, in other areas in Africa. This is a hunger that is so widespread that it is a massive, massive disaster.
It almost sounds like it's economic warfare.
Well, it is economic warfare. This is the conundrum. How do you fight an insurgency? How do you basically partake in or push forward a counterinsurgency against a rebel group without imposing some forms of economic warfare? This is why Yemen is actually going to, I think, personally go forward as an important example of the need for, you know, a reassessment as to how counterinsurgency tactics operate. For instance, it's not illegal. Economic warfare is not illegal. You know, sanctions are a form of economic warfare. But if you, you can try to cut off an income source to rebels, but in doing so, you cut off an income source to millions of people, and economic warfare in this case is, unfortunately, it's just not targeted enough, because the wider effect is just absolutely drawing in the entire population.
So hunger is essentially a weapon of war, because it came out this week in the news that there is enough grain to feed several million people in a port in Hodeidah, but it's at risk of rotting because the aid workers can't get to it to distribute it to people, right?
In Hodeidah, the situation is especially difficult. And what you're finding in Hodeidah is the city itself is controlled by the rebels. Out at sea, that's controlled by the coalition. And so they have been, holding up shipments and making it very difficult for shipments to come in because they want to make sure no weapons are being smuggled. But you also have, in the situation in Hodeidah, rebels that make it very difficult for aid workers to access certain areas. Now, I was in Hodeidah in December, and it took an enormous amount of negotiating just to allow me to go down and film in, you know, the most innocuous areas like streets and on the port. And even in the port, you can only film certain things. So the rebels to make it difficult. And that situation in Hodeidah is one where aid workers are absolutely stuck between a rock and a hard place. They're trying to get shipments in whenever the Saudi-led coalition is making that very difficult. And then once that grain, as you say, is sitting there waiting to feed people, you also have rebels saying, this is a military zone. We don't want foreigners running around here, you know, regardless of whether or not they're helping bring this grain and distributing it to people.
It sounds like this impasse is impossible to break. Is there any movement in terms of international organizations or governments around the world to try to do something about this?
There was a very almost unexpected success to a certain extent in December, where the UN-sponsored talk, they basically brokered a deal where they were able to come up with effectively what's being called the Stockholm Agreement, where both sides agreed in principle to some measures that could, if honored, lead to peace talks. It's much too optimistic to say that it is a peace deal or could lead to a peace deal, but what we've seen is at least in principle, agreeing to do some prisoner swaps, much, much, much wider prisoner swaps were part of the deal. But so far, just a couple of prisoner swaps, very, very, very small stuff at this stage. The agreement was meant to save millions of lives by saving that Hodeidah port. That port is what's keeping everybody alive, because it's effectively, that's where all the food is coming in. Yemen, as a result of its very dysfunctionally run economy for a long time, has become completely dependent on imports. So without imports, food prices will absolutely skyrocket, and that would tip the country into a much wider famine. But for now, this Stockholm deal was meant to help. It was meant to basically mean that the rebels would pull out of the city, and the Saudi-led coalition troops, effectively led by the UAE in there, Yemeni fighters, that had kind of surrounded the city almost entirely, they would pull back too. This was the agreement back in December. So far, that has not happened. It hasn't collapsed, but it has stalled as a result of tit-for-tat arguments. The Saudi-led coalition and their Yemeni allies say that the Houthis aren't pulling out. They're simply changing uniforms and leaving their allies in charge. And the Houthis say that the Saudi-led coalition keep violating the terms of the peace. So that hasn't happened, but so far it hasn't collapsed. And you have the UN Special Representative, Martin Griffiths, who is ferrying back and forth between the two sides frantically, trying to keep this deal alive. It would only really be for Hodeidah, as well as one or two other areas in the country, but it could be the start of possibly some hope of a deal that they could build upon.
And in the last remaining minutes, I want to go back to something you said earlier. You said that this is perhaps worse than other places where you have covered famine and conflict. And you wrote a piece for The New Yorker where you said that even to get into a part of Yemen to tell the story, you had to disguise yourself and dress like a local. Is that part of the problem with the rest of the world seemingly not knowing enough about what's going on in Yemen? Just the access is incredibly difficult?
It is a part of the problem. In fact, it's a huge part of the problem and has been for quite some time. I traveled to Yemen in the summer of 2015 with a group of journalists from CBS, British Sky News, as well as a number of print journalists. And it was, you know, a normal trip. I've been going back and forth to Yemen several times a year for most of my career. And when we left at the end of that week, I just thought, well, I'll be back before the end of the year.
Uh-huh.
And shortly afterwards, commercial flights into Sana'a were stopped.
Uh-huh.
And so only aid agency flights can get into Sana'a, and journalists are expressly banned from those and have been for several years now. The Saudi-led coalition checks the manifest of those flights to make sure no one is getting journalists in there. So for 2 years, I was basically trying to figure out how to get in. I mean, journalists were being pulled off planes before they were allowed to take off. So this has been going on for some time. And as a result, I did have to come up with a fairly elaborate scheme of flying into the south, into coalition controlled areas, and managing to sort of smuggle myself north past dozens and dozens of checkpoints that, you know, we're looking for journalists trying to get up there. So the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition very much so included journalists. They intentionally wanted to prevent pictures and images of this war getting out.
That limits the outrage if people can't see.
Yes, absolutely. There's a fear that journalists getting into the north would come up with the kind of pictures that they did eventually. I mean, you saw Declan Walsh from the New York Times went in September, that image of that little girl on the front page of the New York Times. That's what they wanted to prevent. They didn't quite manage it in the end, but they managed it for a couple of years.
And finally, what's the long-term impact if this impasse can't be broken, if there can't be progress and food gotten to the people who are suffering?
The long-term impact from a humanitarian perspective is really quite disastrous. Even the United Nations can't hold off a famine of this scale. Two-thirds of the 18 million people needing to be fed. You know, that's billions of dollars worth of aid every year. That's not going to be sustainable. And what's the result of that? Obviously, many people die, but you also see an entire generation of children stunted. Malnutrition, you know, if children survive malnutrition, that doesn't mean they haven't had cognitive impairment or they're stunted and short and smaller and weaker. So, I mean, the humanitarian impact is enormous. But also, longer term, and I think this is very important for United States interests, the destabilization of Yemen is very dangerous. What you've seen with certainly in the south, we call it the south, but it includes the east of the country. We've seen fighters that are allied with Al-Qaeda or have been fighting for Al-Qaeda fighting on the side instead of the coalition. We've seen, increased reports coming out of Al-Qaeda linked fighters basically moving west into areas that they weren't in before, in the midst of all of this chaos. So there is a danger of southern Yemen turning into, you know, perhaps it's not quite there yet, but in the future, it could turn into a sort of 1990s Somalia situation, where you do have a degree of lawlessness and an undermining of any real central government there. That would be a very dangerous situation for the wider region and for U.S. foreign policy.
Jane Ferguson, thank you so much. As someone who used to be a journalist, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the fact that you're trying to tell this story and bring it to the world. I'm very grateful you joined me on Smart Women, Smart Power.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Subscribe to the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to good content. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @SmartWomen, and I'm @BeverlyKirk. Thanks for listening. See you next time.